Hi, I'm Santo Subramanian. I'm a managing director with EY in the supply chain and operations practice. About 22 years of experience in helping large global firms improve their supply chain efficiency and resiliency. I'm also the moderator today of this esteemed panel. My job is to really facilitate an engaging discussion, and the panel will share their insights. As you know, the global environment today is evolving at an unprecedented pace. This is a big week as you think about tariffs and all the conversation today. There are a lot of uncertainty, supply chain challenges that we are navigating. Today we'll explore, which is the prime question, whether we are going towards a blue or gray sky in global commerce and how companies are preparing for it. It will be a discussion format. I ask the panelists to feel free to chime in as we go along. The conversation today will focus on three topics, really. Theme one is really understanding what are the market uncertainty and geopolitical risks. What are they seeing? We have a couple of our panelists who were in Washington, D.C. last week testifying, so we'd love to hear from them what they are hearing as well. What are the resilience and optimization strategies that their companies are facing? And then what's the future of global commerce? So that's those three themes we'll hit on. Time permitting, I may take some questions from the audience as well. With that, I'm pleased to introduce our esteemed panel. Let me start with Dan Tadaros. Dan is the Chief Operating Officer of Shipowners Claim Bureau, managers of American P&I Club. In his role, he oversees the day-to-day operations of the club's global offices while driving policies that support corporate governance, compliance, and the organization's long-term vision. Before joining American Club's senior management team, Dan was a maritime lawyer with Schaeff McCall LLP, where he led and handled a wide range of maritime claims, compliance, and regulatory matters. And now another important factor, Dan is a proud new grandfather and a lifelong soccer enthusiast. He's an avid Liverpool Football Club fan, and he often travels to cheer on the Reds. So if you have any Manchester United club, please make sure Dan hears of it. To his left is Ken O'Brien. Ken is the president and CEO of Gemini Shippers Association, one of North America's leading shipper associations. He also serves as the president of Blue Spark, a tech-enabled consulting and logistics services firm. With a deep background in liner shipping, Ken spent over 20 years at APL, Hapag-Lloyd, holding senior trade management and operation roles. Ken is also an avid cook and a bourbon enthusiast. Would love to share my list with you as well, Ken. When he's not refining maritime strategies, you'll likely find him cheering for his Yankees, Knicks, and his beloved Texas A&M teams. And to his left is Bill. Bill Rooney is the Vice President of Strategic Development at Kuehne+Nagel, where he brings over 51 years of experience in transportation management and logistics strategy. Bill has been an institution in this industry, and throughout his career, he has held leadership roles at major shipping and logistics firms, including serving as the president of Hanjin Shipping, senior vice president of service delivery at CMA CGM, and vice president of ocean services at GT Nexus. Bill is a proud grandfather of four wonderful grandkids who keep him on his toes, putting his 50 years of problem-solving skills to test both in logistics and grandparenting. And then finally, we have Joe Kramick. Joe is the president and CEO of the World Shipping Council, where he leads the efforts to shape policies and regulations impacting the global container shipping industry. Under Joe's leadership, WSA continues to address evolving needs of the shipping industry, focusing on sustainable shipping practices, safety, security, and healthy competition. Outside of shipping, global shipping policies, Joe is a passionate craft beer brewer. All right. Wonderful. Welcome, panelists. Let's dive in. This question on a theme one is for all our panelists and is very topical today. How have recent ongoing tariff changes, the ongoing challenges and trade agreement impacting your business and your global supply chains. Bill, would you like to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. I think anybody who's paying attention has seen geopolitics trumping economics, no pun intended, in our business. You know, companies that are managing supply chains now have to consider that first. And you can look at the day-to-day impact. Just take for one example, which is the Suez Canal closing, which has led to a situation where a spike in need for supply, or spike in demand, I guess you could look at it that way. It's driven rates up above where they would have been otherwise. Also, if you look forward from that happening, that one geopolitical event, by the way, which doesn't appear to be coming to an end anytime soon, when that does come to an end, it's probably going to drive somewhere between 5 and 15% more capacity into a system where rates are determined almost entirely, at least in the short run, by supply and demand. So there'll be more rate volatility at that point. You've got a whole raft of other geopolitical risks, whether you want to talk about the Ukraine-Russia war, China being much more active, geopolitically, the alignment of Russia, Iran, and China, making people nervous, China's activities around Taiwan. A lot of this makes people very nervous, and when they're nervous, they make changes to their supply chain decisions. So I think today, I've been in the business almost 52 years, and I tell people, if you take for the first 48 of those or 47 of those, and you took all the disruption, whether it be COVID-like or anything, or ship sinking or union strikes, that kind of thing, you took all that activity, mayhem, over 46, 47, 48 years, and you multiplied it by five, you still would not get close to where we have been the last 3-4 years, if you include COVID, Suez, and other geopolitical risks. So it's unprecedented in its level of uncertainty, and I think unprecedented in its effect on the business.
Dan?
Yeah, if I can take off on what Bill was saying, I was quite impressed to hear what the panelists said this morning. Everything sounded so rosy and great, and it seemed like everyone's making good money and investment in the future. And I see things, at least from the P&I side, I see some pretty dark skies ahead for us. It's now something that the stakeholders, you know, what used to be extraordinary events, now those seem to be happening on a daily basis. There's always something going on. So the risk management has changed completely. And again, Bill mentioned a point about the Suez and others. I'd like to raise something which I read an article the other day from GCaptain that I thought was really on point. This particular author, and to give him credit, was Captain John Conrad, talked about choke points and how choke points around the world are going to influence how shipping really is going to be going for the years to come. And those choke points right now, ladies and gentlemen, I feel are under some severe stress. And when I talk about choke points, I'm talking about, for example, Panama Canal, Suez Canal, Taiwan Strait, the Red Sea. You've got all kinds of players, predominantly China, that have impact on all of that. And I was in Washington with Joe last week, listening to all the testimony about the proposed trade representatives' port charges and everything else that came up. And I've got to tell you, it's going to be complicated going forward.
Thank you. Joe, would you like to add to what you're seeing from your World Shipping Council perspective?
Sure. So, you know, representing liner shipping, we serve the trade and we take the cargo where shippers want it picked up and deliver it to where they want it to go. But as colleagues have said, that's become increasingly complex as you trade globally. I like to talk about it in, you know, there's black swans and there's pink flamingos, and the black swans are like what we see that we can't see coming, like the Red Sea came out of nowhere. I mean, all of a sudden merchant shipping is being attacked by ballistic missiles, and even if they're not entirely successful, they've essentially denied the waterway, and you're going around the continent of Africa. And then pink flamingos are the ones that that you see and you know are there, like the challenge of decarbonization that I think we'll talk about in a little bit. But if you sort of just try to ignore known knowns, and so we try to take a view where, hey, let's look at these known knowns and see if we can solve for them, knowing full well, as Daniel said, there's going to be these things that pop up out of nowhere that you're going to have to adjust for. I too see a lot of clouds on the horizon. But on the other hand, you know, global trade has gone up steadily 3 to 4%. So consumers want the cargoes delivered. We carry them. We own an asset that floats and it's mobile, and so it's constantly adjusting networks to serve the trade. So in some sense, there's opportunities and that's business as usual. But it's becoming increasingly challenging to navigate global trade.
Thank you. Ken, Gemini Shipping represents around 275-plus companies. What are you saying?
Yeah, so I think certainly my comments coming from the voice of the cargo and the shipper. And so we are, you know, we're a shipper association that deals mostly with containerized, mostly with imports into the U.S. And, you know, I was also down in D.C. last week testifying. I think the big question always, right, I come from the liner shipping side. This is about supply and demand, and ultimately, you know, we have a pretty good picture of supply other than what happens in the Red Sea. You know, on the demand side, the real question ultimately becomes is what is the impact of tariff on the consumer? And I think having, as you all went through COVID, I would say, you know, it's probably a bad bet to bet against the American consumer, right? We've seen it, certainly in the retail space during COVID, sales up, generally profits up. But there is a limit. And so, you know, as these tariffs are coming online, certainly the Section 301 on cargo in China, there's really two parts that I think shippers are really, you know, have to think through. One, how quick can they adjust their margin strategy to make sure that they can still make money importing, selling goods to all of us? How much of that will be borne by the factory, currency, the intermediate importer, and then ultimately the end consumer? And then the other part is how quick can they adjust their sourcing strategy to try and drive their sourcing patterns around these tariffs? And that's really hard because the speed at which tariffs are being introduced, it's really hard to say, you know, if you'd said to someone 3 months ago, hey, this China thing looks like a problem, what are you going to do? Many would have said, oh, I'm going to do near sourcing in Canada and Mexico. Well, tomorrow that might turn out to be a pretty bad idea. And so I think, you know, the pace at which change is occurring makes it very hard to adjust. And so when people talk about optimizing their network, it implies you know what's going to happen a little bit, or at least can predict with some level where you can should be steering, where is the safe water. And I think for most importers, that's really been their big challenge for the last couple of years.
Yeah, go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, let me add one thing that has been touched on, but I think it ought to be made clear that, at least in my opinion, and I think the other panelists would agree, this China ship-based fee system, if implemented as proposed, is going to be thermonuclear for the business. I mean, it is going to be incredibly disruptive in many, many different ways to various ports, to carriers, to shippers who are trying to manage supply chains. So if it goes in as suggested or as proposed, it is going to be a huge, huge issue, at least in the short run, but going beyond in terms of impact to almost anything else that's going to happen in the next couple of months or next year or more.
Okay, thank you. Let me come back to you, Bill. So with all these uncertainty, how are shipping companies adjusting their operations and strategies to not only account for the uncertainty, both geopolitical tariffs, but also evolving sanctions and regulatory environments?
I would just say, not to comment specifically about Kuehne+Nagel, but more generally, when you're looking at supply chains, when I talk to shippers, and I would include that, given what uncertainties we face now, is looking at hedging two different ways. One is operationally, so have multiple asset choices, multiple carriers, multiple alliances, multiple gateways, multiple services and key port pairs. So operationally hedge as much as you possibly can, and hedge on the financial side in terms of rate structure. Have some a foot in the spot market as well as having rates, fixed rates, contracted fixed rates. And I think if you If you hedge those two ways, I think almost given anything that you can address or you can react to, you're going to be able to do it if you do. You hedge on the asset side and you hedge on the financial side.
Joe?
Yeah, so as a trade association, we're less involved in the financials and the operational. So, but we do, you know, go before all these regulators and try to explain the business as well as up on U.S. Capitol Hill and Brussels, et cetera. And so it is, there is a lack of misunderstanding in this country, frankly, that they get 80% of their goods, both inbound and outbound, by containerized shipping. And when you have an administration that proposes multi-million-dollar fees, your exposure could be up to $3.5 million per port call if you're a Chinese operator with a Chinese-built vessel and you have Chinese vessels on your order book. So a liner ship is going to make 4 stops coming down the East Coast, sometimes as many as 6. That's a tremendous amount of extra cost, in that we cautiously assess that's going to be about $600 to $800 a box on a 6,500 TEU ship, and it may double the cost of U.S. exports. So if you think of farmers who are usually moving low margin goods, they're getting the backhaul. So the head haul, our members make about 80% on, and the backhaul about the other 20%, about $700 to take a box of exports from U.S. to Asia. It's going to double their prices. That's going to eliminate entire commodities like exports of hay and other low-value ag. And so people aren't really digesting this until I think last week when you saw such a broad coalition come out. I can tell you, like, not everyone is on my side of the V as an ocean carrier usually when rates go up. And so there was, other than the steel union petitioners and steel producers and some maritime unions, there was almost universal opposition. And let's not ignore the other side of that proposal, which is the export requirement that says from 1% ratcheting up over 7 years to 15% of goods, U.S. exports have to be shipped on U.S. built ships. It's impossible to comply with. They don't exist. I just heard our gas colleagues up here, a gas ship hasn't been built in the United States since 1980. So it's simply unclear how to comply with an impossible requirement. And these are the, you know, challenges that we try to bring as a trade association to regulators, to the White House, and just to get them to understand shipping, to hopefully, you know, they have an open view and can modify these proposals to become more workable.
Yeah, if I may add, to take off on what Joe was saying, you know, up until 3 years ago, you go to Washington and they thought that a shipper was the ship owner or the operator of the vessel. So for the last 3 years, at least from the P&I Club side, we've spent countless hours, both as the American P&I Club, but also as the international group, visiting all these agencies in Washington to explain what shipping is really all about, and to explain that a shipper is somebody who has to do with the cargo on the cargo side, not really the operator of the vessel. So a lot has changed over the last 3 years. We now know that the Washington has a maritime desk at the White House. There's a maritime desk at the State Department. There's a tremendous focus on shipping. And to talk about, even though we don't get involved on the operational commercial side of our ship owner members, what we have seen is an increase, a tremendous increase in compliance, in having to follow the daily change in rules. Because, mind you, it's not the U.S. nowadays that issues sanctions and changes regulations. Now you've got Europe and you've got the United Kingdom. And as we progress toward what I think is going to be a complete ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine, I believe that the U.S. sanctions are going to lessen, while the EU's are just going to continue or maybe even get more severe, which is going to put everyone in a conflict situation. And it's going to be quite interesting to see how operators are going to deal with that if they're based in Europe or if they do trade with the United States.
Okay, thank you. Speaking of regulations and compliance requirements, in 2025, shipping companies must comply with both IMO as well as EU ETS regulations. How are these evolving environmental and regulatory requirements affecting shipping operations and costs? Joe, you want to start with that?
Sure. So what's really interesting here is that from the liner shipping perspective, we're kind of the early adopter and ahead of many other sectors in terms of decarbonization. I like to say our members bought the latest iPhone, but they don't know what the operating software is going to be that's put on it. And so we have 200 dual fuel ships on the water right now and 700 on the order books, representing conservatively $200 billion in new build investment. But the question is, are they going to run the old fuels or the new fuels? Because the new fuels are 3 to 4 times at least as much and to operate on. And they also don't exist. So you're in this, you know, this dance where you're trying to, you know, the EU has sort of tried to put the spurs into the International Maritime Organization by putting its regulations in place. But the fuels still aren't being produced. I was at the Brussels European Shipping Summit just last week, and it's a curious thing why, you know, the fuel producers haven't taken off, and they look at you and they say, well, you need to have the demand, and the demand's really not going to be there until you get a global framework. And so in one sense, the EU did something very good by putting the spurs into IMO, but in another sense, it's very risky taking these regional patchwork solutions. So this next 2 weeks here, IMO will be in session with a greenhouse gas working group leading up to MEPC 83, where they really need to come together on this global framework. And we all know we want some certainty out there to tell us what this looks like so that we can get these, you need to have a measure that balances out the price gap of this 3 to 4 CapEx. Because at the end of the day, when you're carrying boxes, you're like two grocery stores with low margins selling the same can of clam chowder. And so the margins really do count. You can't run against a competitor who is, you know, 3 to 4 times CapEx less than you. And that's where the focus really needs to be. And it's going to take some work because there's still a lot of disagreement amongst the member states.
Thank you. Bill, how do you see these affecting the shipping operation cost and any investments to adjust for these regulations?
I would say when I look at the regulations, and I would say they do a couple of things. They slow down supply chains and they make them more expensive. And I think, Joe brought up something, which is, well, how do you move forward? And a lot of talk about alternative fuels, but they're a lot more expensive. Nobody's making them. You can't transport them. Getting them onto the boats is difficult. So, and you really don't yet, I don't think, have a global agreement on what has been being pushed, which is a global carbon tax. You have ETS in the EU, but there's enough parties who, as far as I can tell, who don't agree that we should have a carbon tax. So it's very uncertain, and I think some of the uncertainty you can see in what's happened in the last couple of years. Year one, LNG is the sexy fuel, then it's methanol, then they go back and forth from time to time. You still have, I think, a third, maybe more than a third of the fleet is running scrubbers, so they're saying you're hedging that way. I personally think LNG is going to be the transition that's going to win, and I personally have a lot of hope for nuclear. I think ABS is here somewhere. I saw their sign outside, and there's an organization in China. Both have said they think nuclear is going to be viable within 10 years. These molten salt reactors, much smaller, less cargo space. They can run faster. You don't have to refuel them. And if that's around within 10 years, that's still well within the IMO's target of 2040 of a 70% reduction compared to 2008 in greenhouse gas emissions. So my sense is those alternative fuels may not end up making it. LNG will, and over a relatively small number of years, certainly relative to the 2040, nuclear may be real if we can sort out not the technology of the reactors themselves, but also all the regulatory issues surrounding calling at all ports and that kind of thing, and insuring the ships, which is a real problem. The reason there aren't any today, is I understand, is the insurance companies won't insure them commercially. So, but I think that's going to be the end game.
That's going to send the insurance heads spinning and blowing out of proportion when you talk about nuclear fueled vessels. Can you imagine? We already have a shortage in crew. We have a shortage in crew training. How is all that going to come into play? That's going to increase the risk tremendously. One of our members switched over to ammonia, and luckily it's smaller, newly built tugs, and that's part of the problem that we're seeing. He's talking about having to retrain U.S. crew, because this is a U.S.-based member, on how to use ammonia and what comes into play with that. What are the new risks that we have to face from the insurance standpoint? So it's evolving constantly, every day.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to the second theme, which is what are the strategies to address this? So, Ken, maybe I'll start with you. How are companies optimizing their operations to maintain efficiency and competitiveness, right? When you think about challenges such as fluctuating demand, rising costs, and the need for improved customer engagement, performance improvement, what are the strategies that you see there?
Yeah, sure. You know, just maybe before I answer that, just finishing off on the carbon discussion a bit. You know, I think, Joe, I'd agree the liner carriers have leaned into decarbonization faster than most, and that's great. I think, and the discussion today really has been about, you know, what types of fuel and that. But what hasn't been discussed and what has so far, you know, I found vexing and find vexing is who's going to pay for it. And so in 23, we started an organization called Greenable about decarbonization, and it was really about trying to figure out price elasticity for green fuel and what were shippers willing to pay. And what we found is, you know, after 2 years, that organization, everyone wants to measure their emissions, but no one particularly wants to pay for their emissions. And so I think for everyone in the room who's responsible for operating ships, it's really, I think it's time to start thinking about commercial strategy. Because if commercial strategy is just, well, it depends where supply and demand is, and if it's in my favor, they'll pay us. If it isn't, I'll pay. I think there's a lot of balance sheet and EBITDA implication there that's a little scary. And then going on to just, you know, kind of preparing for the future and how are the companies we work with, both in the consulting side and the Shippers Association, you know, that, you know, Bill said maintaining operational flexibility is, I think, number one. The truth is, anyone who says they know what's going to happen tomorrow is probably wrong. I know I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I have some ideas, but I'll probably be right on a couple and wrong on a couple too. And so flexibility in your supply chain, I think, is number one. And so that's really about, you know, the partners we pick and then really, you know, how we serve the markets we're in. And so for the containerized trade, right, we think a lot about gateway strategy, West Coast, East Coast, intermodal versus truck. And then really, I think, you know, the other part is, people don't spend enough time, you know, talking about their vendors in the real way that they should, which is partners. And so for us, we spend an inordinate amount of time really learning, spending time with our carriers. We don't call them vendors. We call them partners. What do they need? What are their operational constraints? What's the underlying math of their business? Because it just absolutely does no good at the end of the day for cargo owners. And I remind our members, you know, until you paint your name down the side of a ship, you have a partner. And that's just the way it is. I remind our steamship line partners, until you have cargo, you too have a partner. It's me. And so that binary action that we see and often play out, we've been trying to dispel that. And I think as you plan for a very uncertain market, you have to accept the fact that this really is a very symbiotic relationship that we're all stuck in, and you just have to make the best of it. And they can't have that win-lose mentality.
Anyone else like to add on that? No. Let's move on to a second question over here. When you think about resilience and optimization strategy, how is technology, including AI and automation, transforming global commerce, logistics, and trade flows? What are you seeing, Joe? How is this?
Well, we really see a lot of opportunity in that. You'll see all the big liners have reworked their networks recently. And certainly, you know, that's a factor in that. We also have a tremendous problem with mariner recruitment, and we see AI and some of these new technologies being really interesting to young people that, hey, maybe this is an interesting career. I can see the world, and it's also technology driven. And so there's a lot of interest in that. But actually, I think the logistics folks would probably have the more relevant points here, because, I mean, that's really what you're doing, is using that AI to try to more efficiently move cargo.
Bill?
I'll mention a couple things. From our perspective, we're non-asset. And what we see in the pretty near future are a couple of things. One is people think AI is going to replace people. I don't think in our business we don't think so. I think it's more going to be an enhancement for people who deal with customers. So you're not going to replace a person. You're going to make a person better at what they do in terms of dealing with their clients. I think that's number one. I think a thing that is out there now and it will be deployed by ourselves and others is dynamic arrival, which is really, you know, doing it to a port is not that big, has not been that big a deal, but to have a dynamic arrival you can give to a client for the actual door delivery is a pretty big deal. And developing that or using that via AI is a pretty big deal, and that's pretty much upon us. Not to speak for the railroads, but there are other applications in the hardware end of the business, but that I think may have application in almost for any asset are things like locomotive maintenance, track maintenance, where you can predict that a failure, you know, 2 days before it would have happened, so you can change the part. That kind of thing is already out there, already being used. I suspect it may show up on any other assets, but from a service provider perspective, I think support to enhance the customer service experience for a client and things like, which has never been out there, to sort of be able to dynamically say this box will arrive on Tuesday at your DC in Kansas City, that's a pretty big deal and that's pretty upon us at this point.
Ken?
Yeah, I'd add a couple parts. Agree with everything Bill said. You know, I think unfortunately the liner carriers have been a bit behind the curve on technology. That's I guess you could argue, not a good thing, right? They've invested an enormous amount of capital in the ships themselves, terminals, which is really, you know, that is the good side of that. The other good side is it's created an amazing ecosystem of startups in technology and transportation, something that just didn't exist 10 years ago. And so, you know, a lot of those startups have built products that really are really features. Eventually, many of those will come and go and they'll merge. But what we're really seeing is, you know, inside for the containerized space, you know, that journey between descriptive, you know, predictive, prescriptive, you know, logistics anchored by, you know, machine learning, you can argue eventually by AI, they'll all say more machine learning right now. There's a lot we could do. And so we've gone from just thinking about, you know, where's my stuff, which is really what we've been thinking about, track and trace and trying to predict where the box is and using AIS data. You know, what we're starting to see now is much more tuning models around, you know, goods in transit become inventory. And so for years, it's always been what's in the box, it crosses an ocean and no one knows about it. And when it finally gets to the DC, it's inventory. I think with a lot of the technology now, we're really starting to see companies think about, you know, their inventory on the water is inventory at that point. And that's really, I think, a data play, which ultimately increases their ability to, you know, leverage cash.
Yeah, you know, a few years ago, paperless trade on blockchain was the rage. Even if AI does hold a lot of promises, but it's still to be seen. Dan, I don't know if you'd like to add anything from the P&I perspective.
Yeah, I would, both from the P&I Club perspective and also from our members' perspective. So AI and automation advancements have really played a key role in KYC, know your client, and KYCC, know your client's client. Ever since the United States through OFAC imposed on all the P&I clubs to have AIS service to track their vessels that are entered with that particular club, where their vessels are going, AI has been a tremendous improvement so that we can monitor when there are vessels that are engaged in what's known as spoofing, or transmitting false locations of where they are, and when there's STS operations. So this will continue to develop as government regulators continue to put the pressure on the insurance industry to monitor the vessels.
If I could just come behind that, one project that World Shipping Council is working on is a cargo safety program. We still have a shipboard fire due to non-declared or misdeclared hazardous goods, depending on which P&I club you talk to, every 30 to 100 days. And so we are implementing that technology with our members, but in a careful way that because shippers are our customers, but to see if we can get after in a little bit more of that problem of misdeclared and non-declared hazardous goods. And we see great upside for that, because that same technology and scanning of bills of lading and the more information you feed the machine, the more it learns, is also starting to show you other anomalies that could be used for illicit trafficking of narcotics, of wildlife, et cetera. And so we're really putting a lot of effort into that side.
Can I add
one
thing to that? I would just a couple of things. One is the industry, I'm talking about containerized international ocean transportation, I don't want to say has been burned, but has been, maybe misled isn't the right word either, but you mentioned blockchain, but there's been a long series of sort of promises made on the technology front that haven't come through. Certainly blockchain didn't. We've been trying, and I've been involved in this for 30 years or more, better data so you can do what is referred to as visibility or track and trace. That still isn't there yet. And to sort of put technological advancements aside for a minute, you still have ships that are only on time 50% of the time. So you're maybe focus on AI and technological improvements, which everybody's doing and should do, but you have this elephant in the room, which is the fact that the ships are on time only half the time. And how you manage inventory, and if you think AI and technology is going to help you manage inventory, that's great. But on the other hand, the ships are off time half the time. And dealing with that, to me, is, in the short run, a bigger issue than the technological advances, which will come over time, but you got to get the boats back on time, which they clearly aren't now.
Okay. All right. Let me switch to the future of global commerce here and open this up to all the panelists here. What emerging trends do you foresee shaping global commerce over the next 3 to 5 years, and how do companies prepare for it? Bill, maybe you can start us off.
Yeah. I would note that if you look back at global trade from, say, 1990 until the Great Recession, was growing at basically 10% a year. It was gangbusters, right? And since the Great Recession, it's been a good year is 3%. And I've seen forecasts for this year that range from 1.5% to 3%. So the first thing is global trade has slowed down significantly. If you read the industry press, you're going to see where they say, hey, globalization has tapped out more or less. You're going to see higher growth rates in intra-regional trade. I think that's going to be important. I think a lot of it depends on what happens with the tariffs and trade war. I think it's the uncertainty is there, and I think it's going to be slower growth. You're going to see faster growth probably in intra-regional trade as opposed to inter-regional trade, which was, as I said, booming in from the late 70s, actually late 60s, all the way through the Great Recession. I think the big thing is slower growth and growth being distributed somewhat differently, and we have to wait and see how tariffs change supply chains. Does more and more business move to Southeast Asia? Does more and more business move out of China into Mexico? Does more move back to the U.S.? I think that's, as somebody said before, we're going to know more in the next couple of days about tariffs and stuff, but I think a big, big unknown continues to be the level of tariffs and the general geopolitical risk as well.
Dan, emerging trends?
Yes, so we have 4 years of the Trump administration going forward, so there's no doubt, and I'm going to repeat something that I said at a conference in Greece a couple months ago. President Trump is both very predictable and in many ways completely unpredictable. So the next 4 years are going to be a hell of a ride for all of us, because it's going to be up and down with tariffs. He's going to use those to for political reasons to gain advantages. And listen, he is 100% in tune with rebuilding the U.S. merchant marine and rebuilding what has dropped off for a number of years now, which is the U.S.'s supremacy in the seas. And that's not happening anymore. Nowadays, you see instances where even our closest allies, the United Kingdom, Norway, for example, are kind of playing hardball every now and then with us, especially when it comes to those choke points. So strap your seatbelt on. It's going to be an interesting ride going forward.
So Bill's exactly right. Since the global financial crisis, containerized trade has essentially grown at 1.5 times GDP. Before that, you used to use, as a trade guy, we used to say 3X. you know, and before that you would say it was, you know, 3.5x. And so you say, well, is this slowing, you know, at the end of the day, I think it all depends on, you know, what's the aperture. You know, if I zoom in, you know, this is going to, you know, we're going to have moderated growth. If I zoom out and look at from 1956 till now, containerized trade has only gone up. And so, you know, we're going to have these bumps in the road via geopolitical tariff. But I think the long-term prognosis is an upward trending line. And so I think it's easy to get tied up in the emotion of the day. I think the hard part is when you let the emotion of the day decide the strategy for the 20-year, 25-year lifespan of a ship. And so I feel pretty darn good about the overall trajectory, though I think there's some bumps in the road. I think the movement, you know, certainly the movement out of China for manufacturing, that is happening. That's a demographic. There's a lot of reasons for it. I think certainly Southeast Asia is going to continue to play a role. I think, and then really, you know, where we see, you know, certainly the growth, Indian subcon, we see that as certainly, you know, an engine.
Thank you. Joe, I'll give you the final quick word
here.
I
agree with Ken on it's these emerging markets. I mean, the U.S. we need to get some clarity here on what this tariff situation is going to be and how shippers and ocean carriers are going to adjust to serve this market, which is the world's largest economy. But there's a lot of other big areas to trade that are emerging out there, and so there's a lot of opportunities to build up trade with those areas.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panelists, audience, and Capital Link for a very insightful session. Yeah.